In our study last week, we were trying to review some things. I've called this the final outline of Daniel, and it's likely to be revised, so perhaps I need to rename it. But in our study, we have examined the first chapter and determined that the theme of the first chapter has to do with Daniel and his determination to keep himself pure from the defilements of King Nebuchadnezzar. In the first few verses, or few chapters, the first six chapters of this book, we see evident God's providence in history, and that's going to be the point of emphasis that we want to deal with hopefully tonight, and maybe we'll get into some other things. But as we continue into the second chapter of the book of Daniel, what's the predominant discussion of that chapter? David? Bruce? What's the predominant discussion of the second chapter of Daniel? All right, the dream that King Nebuchadnezzar received. The dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had. Randy, what was it?
This again. Huh?
This again. Did I ask you that question last week? Oh, sorry about that. You want me to pass it to somebody else?
No, I can answer it. It was corrupted by a giant statue.
All right.
But as far as what it broke down, let's see, the head was gold and the shoulders were bronze. I have to look again.
Okay. All right, the chest and arms were of silver, and the stomach and thighs were of bronze, and then the legs and feet were iron and clay. All right, very good. And the image that appeared to Nebuchadnezzar in his dream, what did it mean, Jonathan? All right, and those four kingdoms were what?
Started with Babylonian.
All right.
Persian, down to the Greeks,
into the Romans. All right, very good. All right, very good.
The foundation for the rest of the figurative parts of the book.
All right, that's right.
It lays the foundation for all of the others.
That's right, it does. Everything else kind of becomes an overlay over Daniel chapter 2. That's right. All right. Then, Carolyn, in the third chapter, what do we read about? Give you a hint. I say I'll give you a hint.
I'm blanking out.
All right. Who wants to help her out? The third chapter. Dick?
It was saved in the fire.
All right. And their names were? Their Babylonian names? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And Richard, their Hebrew names were?
Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah.
Very good. I knew that you knew that. That's why I asked you. And then in the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel, we see that Nebuchadnezzar has a second dream. And what was the dream? Who wants that? Nobody wants that. Jenny. All right. All right.
A watchman came, said to chop the tree down, or wrap the stump in a band of iron to teach Nebuchadnezzar to be watchful.
All right. And the significance of all of that was, what was the watchman? And I think you answered that. My mind might have been drifting just a little bit.
Nebuchadnezzar was the tree.
Oh, okay. You
the
did answer that. That's right, and cut him down. And what happened to cut him down, Carolyn? You remember that?
He lost his mind.
Yeah, he did. He lost his mind.
He like an animal.
He did. And so when he finally surrendered, did he return to his sanity? And he lifted, as he lifted up his eyes to heaven, he praised the God of Daniel. Now, one of the things that was observed in our previous studies that we want to underscore in our study tonight is that though Nebuchadnezzar praises the God of Daniel, and has done so a number of times, he only praises the God of Daniel as one of many gods. He even goes so far as to speak concerning the greatness of the God of Daniel, but again, one of many gods. And so this was a problem that King Nebuchadnezzar had, and I suggest to you that it's one that somewhat permeates these first six chapters of the book of Daniel. Yes, Richard?
I was going to say right there at the end of chapter 4 where Nebuchadnezzar is talking, he calls him the king of heaven. I think we see that he seemed to acknowledge at some time that Jehovah God was the chief god of many of these gods.
But one of many.
But one of many.
Yeah,
right.
One of many. Still others, that's right. That's what his conception was. And as we come into the fifth chapter, we've got a new man on the scene. Who is he? Yes, Daryl? I don't know if Daniel just flat tells him that in so many words, but that's the message that Daniel is communicating to him and showing superiority of the one God over anything else that King Nebuchadnezzar perceived as God. David?
Well, you know, in the New Testament, Paul says that in times past, God linked to him. The Jewish religion was not an evangelistic religion. I mean, they didn't have the cross lights and the prophets. It wasn't set up to go out and teach the other nations how to be children of God. It was not an evangelistic religion like the Christian religion is. And of course, in the time past, God did bring that religion. It was not, again, his divine plan to send the Jews out to redeem. In fact, the Jews were supposed to be withdrawn from
Right, keeping themselves separate, Deuteronomy 7.
So it wasn't set up for that kind of evangelistic theories that the Christian religion is, and that's God winked at it. Now he's sending Christians out to preach about him and the one and only God.
That's true. In Acts, the 14th chapter, I was trying to think of the parallel passage of the one that you were mentioning in Acts, the 17th chapter. In Acts, the 14th chapter and verse 16, it says, "Who in the generations gone by suffered all the nations to walk in their own ways?" So yes, there was a time when God just allowed these people to think what they wanted to think. There were prophets that were sent among the people of God, and there were prophets that were sent even among those who were not the people of God. But God didn't foreclose on the mortgage, so to speak, at that time. He allowed things to continue until the fullness of times that we've talked about a little bit in our study of the book of Daniel. So, Daryl, to answer your question, I don't know if there is just a passage that point blank tells Nebuchadnezzar, but that's the essence of the communication that Daniel has with Nebuchadnezzar. There is only one God, and he's greater than anything you've ever known. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, well, got one, I think, in Psalms 15. Yeah, another one in Isaiah. Pardon me? Jenny? I don't think he directly tells him that. I'm trying to think of the passage that Daryl was referring to. I don't know that it's necessary for me to look that up, but I could find it just shortly. I think it's Psalms 15 or Psalms 115. Well, there is one in Isaiah that talks, it is in Isaiah that talks about the tree. But I have written beside the margin in Psalms which passage it is in Isaiah. Isaiah 44, thank you.
I mean, the Bible, the Jews didn't teach other people. They just didn't go out and in the better way.
Right. Just come on in. We're studying in the book of Daniel.
Okay.
We're in Daniel chapter 5 now. Doing a review of the book, Daniel chapter 5. And if you don't have a Bible right handy, there's some laying around somewhere. There you go. Daniel chapter 5. Psalm 115. Okay, that's correct then. Psalm 115. Daniel chapter 5. What's the theme of that chapter? Who are we studying about, Terry?
The handwriting on the wall.
All right, the handwriting on the wall. And it appeared before King Belshazzar, and we noticed that the reason that it appeared before him was what? What was it he was doing? All right, and when he seen, or saw rather, a man's finger writing on the wall, what effect did it have upon Belshazzar?
Kind of went into shock.
He went into shock, yes. The Bible tells us that his knees smote one against the other. I understand that feeling, yes.
Not only were they drinking wine from him, but they were praising the gods of silver and gold and iron and wood and stone.
All right, that's right. Quite the opposite of what the utensils were intended to do. And so he saw a man's finger, and the man's finger began to write upon the wall, and it scared him to death. His thoughts troubled him. Verse 6. And, of course, he calls in men to try to tell him what the writing meant. And could any of the enchanters or soothsayers or magicians of the kingdom of Babylon tell him what the handwriting meant?
They could not read the writing.
They could not read the writing. Now, how did he find out what the writing meant? Said. Now there's some details need to be filled in here. How did he know? Well, Daniel told him, but how did he know to get Daniel? The queen. All right, the queen remembered these things about his father, King Nebuchadnezzar. And so the queen told Belshazzar that there is a man that God has blessed so he can explain these type things that the enchanters and magicians cannot explain. And so Daniel is brought before the king. And Daniel begins then at verse 17 to explain to him the meaning of what he saw on the wall. But before he does that, he introduces Belshazzar to some things pertaining to his father. What does he tell Belshazzar about his father that he should have known? All right. And if you'll notice at verse 22 of Daniel chapter 5, it says, "And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thy heart, though thou knewest all this." You know what happened to your father, and you didn't do any better than he did. And so now this has come to pass upon you. Now, again, Daryl, as Daniel reminds Belshazzar of the God who is about to do something to him, he says to Belshazzar in verse 23, the latter part of the verse, he says, "Which see not nor hear," as he speaks concerning these idols, "nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified?" Now that speaks volumes. Belshazzar, here's what you've done. By way of contrast, here's what your father did, and here is the one who is responsible for all that you are and all that you have, and you fail to glorify him. Again, that speaks volumes. Now, the hand wrote on the wall. Terry, what did the hand write? And then Jonathan, what was the meaning of the words that the hand wrote? Okay, Terry? All right. He's supposed to answer the rest of that. Yes, sir.
The first part is God has numbered the days of your kingdom and finished it. And the next describes how it says you've been weighed in balances and found wanting. And then final phrase says that his kingdom will be divided between the East and the West.
All right, very good. And would Belshazzar die in battle with the Medes and the Persians? All right, he's murdered in his sleep. It says, in that night, verse 30, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 80 years old. Now, in the midst of all of this, and we want to make a notation here, is a change in the line of the kings. We're no longer now talking about the kings of Babylon, but now we're talking about the kings of the Medes and the Persians. And that brings us to the subject of Darius and Daniel in the lion's den. And as we discussed Daniel in the lion's den, what was it that some knew about Daniel? They brought this to the attention of the king in sort of a sneaky way. All right, Daniel prayed regularly. And because he prayed regularly, can't hardly say that word. Joey, what was it then that certain men among the Persians wanted Darius to do?
They wanted to punish him or kill him because his allegiance was to the Lord, not to the king.
All right, and how do they arrange to do that? They've got to catch Daniel doing the very thing they know he does. So how do they arrange to do that?
Make a law against it.
Make a law against it. Daniel is a praying man. He prays at certain set times during the day. So we'll make a law or impose upon the king to make a law that makes that illegal. So you can't ask anything of any other god. Now I find that interesting the way that it's worded at verse 7. The latter part of the verse, chapter 6, verse 7, about the middle of the verse says that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now they knew that Daniel would do that, that Daniel would pray to the one true and living God. And in verse 10 of Daniel chapter 6, it says, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house. Now his windows were open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, and he kneeled upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. This was Daniel's practice. This is what he did. And the decree of the king was not about to change that. Now, when Daniel made his petition before God, how was that responded to by these who have accused Daniel or want to accuse Daniel? They then bring that to the attention of the king. Here's Daniel. Here's what he did. He transgressed the declaration or the decree that you have signed. Now, what was unique in some degree about the decree that Darius had signed? That's right. Once he had signed it, it could not be overturned. And so when Daniel was found praying unto God, what was it that Darius was bound to do? Ken? What was he going to do with him? What was it that the king was going to do with Daniel? What did he have to do once he found out that Daniel prayed? Has to put him in the lion's den. That's right. Now, does Darius really want to do that?
No,
he doesn't really want to do that. But nonetheless, because the decree had been made and could not be undone, it was necessary that he do that. Now,
we see later on, too, about the Persian king, they go back and check what the Persian king wrote. It's that they're a little strict on this particular.
That's right. Carolyn, Bruce, and Joey.
Who Daniel
another chapter, they're concerned that they're going to, their position is going to go down a little because Daniel's about to get promoted, and they just want a canon. And he's so good that they can't even find anything wrong with him. They have to you know, find, they have to create something to try to get him knocked down, knocked out of there.
That's right.
I always thought that was interesting, that someone would be so good that they'd have to, he has no skeletons in the closet, so to speak.
They have to invent something. Yeah, yeah. Bruce? All right. Daniel didn't seem to be afraid, did he? Joey?
Well, you just alluded to what I was going to say. There's a very powerful lesson here for us today, and that is that when we as Christians are threatened with some kind of difficulty or punishment for our faith, we have to follow the example of Daniel and not waver. We can't backpedal and quit doing what we know God expects from us just because there may be some crisis. Daniel did not waver. He didn't cower and say, "Well, I'm going to quit praying because I'm going to get in trouble." And right. There's a very powerful lesson there for us today: to remain faithful, even when the challenges may mandate that we go through tough times.
All right, that's right. That's right. And so Daniel is preserved in the lion's den. The lions didn't touch him. They didn't bother him. And then what happened to those who were his accusers? They accidentally did, didn't they? And of course, along with their whole families. So there was some consequences for what occurred. In this chart, we've emphasized that the theme of the book of Daniel is that God rules in the kingdoms of men. And I want to look at some of the passages. In fact, I want to look at all of them that are on this chart and ask you to read them because they emphasize that theme throughout these first six chapters. In chapter 1, in verse 17, it says, "Now as for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." It was God who blessed these young men with the abilities that they had. And then in chapter 2, at verse 21, the text tells us that he changeth the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings, and giveth wisdom unto the wise, and knowledge to them that have understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers. Now Daniel is saying these things, of course, about God, but it emphasizes the power that God has, the greatness of God. And then at verse 28, as Daniel is brought before King Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel says, "But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and he hath made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days." Daniel, contrary to the magicians and soothsayers and enchanters of the Babylonians, attributes whatever revelation that he is to give to King Nebuchadnezzar, that the revelation of that comes from God. And then at chapter 2, verse 47, the king answered unto Daniel and said, "Of a truth, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing that thou hast been able to reveal this secret." Nebuchadnezzar exalts God, but again, only as one of many gods. And then in chapter 3, at verse 28, it tells us that Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's word, and have yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God." Now, though King Nebuchadnezzar praises Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and praises and exalts the God that they serve, yet we see in the latter expression that they serve, they not serve nor worship any God except their own God. The implications in that is that Nebuchadnezzar once again believes that there is a plurality of gods. And further, in the fourth chapter at verse 2, Nebuchadnezzar the king says, "It hath pleased or seemed good unto me to show the signs and wonders that the Most High God hath wrought toward me." Again, Nebuchadnezzar is the one that recognizes the greatness of God and acknowledges that there are signs and wonders that the Most High God has showed unto him. And then in chapter 4 at verse 17, it says, "The sentence is by the decree of the watchers and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the lowest of men." And further in this same chapter, in chapter 4 at verse 25, "Thou shalt be driven from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and thou shalt be made to eat grass as oxen, and shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee, till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." Daniel is being emphatic in the words that he uses to the king, though he doesn't just simply say there is one, but you could draw the conclusion from what he says that he is telling King Nebuchadnezzar, there is one. And then in chapter 4, beginning at verse 32, "And thou shalt be driven from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and thou shalt be made to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdoms of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." And then in verse 34, "And at the end of the days I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom from generation to generation." And then in the fifth chapter, to Belshazzar, in verse 21, Daniel reminds him of the events of his father in the latter part of the verse, "until he knew that the Most High God ruleth in the kingdom of men, and that he setteth up over it whomsoever he will." And then, of course, in the passage that we're looking at in the sixth chapter at verses 26 and 27, he says, "I make a decree that all the dominion of my kingdom, I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end." Now, as we look at these passages, we see time and time and time again that Daniel records the greatness of the one true God and that he rules in the kingdoms of men. As many times as you see that stated just in the first six chapters regarding the providence of God in history, that God rules among the kingdoms of men. We ought not be ashamed nor in any way hesitant to recognize that God still rules in the kingdoms of men. Do you believe that's so? And we've emphasized in our studies up to this point, not only this point, but we've also tried to incorporate into this point the text of 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, where we are instructed to pray for those who are in positions of power, that we might lead a quiet and tranquil life. If God does not rule in the kingdoms of men, why pray for that? God would have nothing that he could do about it to begin with, you see. But God does rule. He still rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he will to accomplish his ends and to accomplish his purposes. Now, as we continue just a little farther in our study, I want to get into part 2 of the book of Daniel. And admittedly, it's from chapter 7 through chapter 12 that the book gets more complicated. Yes, Daryl?
Administration after administration.
what it says, and we've got to accept it as true. But not only are we looking at the present and hopeful perhaps for the future, but we can look back into the past, such as we are tonight in the study of these world kingdoms, and see that the corruptness that exists today is not a new thing. It has always been so, and men have rarely recognized and worshiped the one true and living God. Saw another hand. David? All right, the key there is to depend on Him. It's easy for us to stand before other people and talk about faith, quotation marks. It's very difficult when we're on the testing line and our faith is being tried to practice the very things that we now know to be true. There's where, as we use the expression, the rubber meets the road. That's the test. Whether or not you really do believe the things that you say you believe is when you're in that situation and you have to apply the truths that you've learned to yourself. Now that's the test of faith. All right? Any other questions or comments, Carolyn, before we get on to chapter 7?
Talking about praying for leaders, I think sometimes people mistake that for thinking that, well, then a godly man's going to get into office. And I can't think of a time in history when that actually has
We can find a godly woman who was brought to that place. Esther.
Well, we're talking, yes. Rare. You've got thousands of years of history.
Yeah.
You're not going to find very many.
That's true.
But God has all kinds of purposes that we just simply don't see.
Yes. Randy?
And the other side of that coin is He raises up some ungodly people, takes it right to the top so they can take down the other.
He did the Chaldeans. Right. And the perplexity of that is seen in the book of Habakkuk, where the man just didn't know, or the prophet did not understand, why God allowed the people of Israel to just go farther and farther and farther and farther into sin and do nothing about it. God says, I got a plan for that. I'm going to raise up somebody and they're going to take care of them. And of course, Habakkuk wants to know, how are you going to do that? And he says, I'm going to raise up the Chaldeans. And now that just blows Habakkuk's mind, because they're so much worse than the people of God. And he says, don't worry about that. I've got a plan for that. I'm going to take care of them. Now, that's a very loose paraphrase of the text of Habakkuk, but that's the theme of the book, as we see beginning in the first chapter. Any other comments before we get to the seventh chapter? All right, the seventh chapter changes the tone just a little bit. It begins to discuss God's purpose in history. And there we are introduced to a dream that Daniel has. And in the dream that Daniel has, what does he dream? Four great beasts, yes. And the first one was like what? The first one was like a lion, and the second one was like a bear, and the third one was like a leopard, and the fourth one was not like anything. The fourth one is described as a terrible and powerful beast, strong exceedingly, and it hath great iron teeth. It devoureth and breaketh in pieces, and stamped the residue with its feet, and was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns, and it goes on to describe some other things. But this fourth beast, David, help me out here. This fourth beast, what did it represent, and how do we know?
Well,
represented Rome. That's right. And we know that that's so as we turn the page just a little bit over to verse 23 of this same chapter. It says, "Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom upon the earth." Now, as it's described as a diverse kingdom, here's the overlay from Daniel chapter 2. The four kingdoms identified in Daniel chapter 2, the last of which was the Roman kingdom. And the Roman kingdom was made up, it tells us, of iron and clay. It was a diverse kingdom. It was different from those that had existed prior to it. And so this fourth beast, representing the fourth kingdom, in this dream, what was the significance of it? All right, again, we see the point emphasized that God's in control. And as we look further into this seventh chapter, we see that God gives a kingdom. And we'll just talk about that. Terry, go ahead, and then I'll talk about that. All right.
About history, in order to accomplish his plan, you see the significance of the divine timetable. That, when you study this enough in order to teach it, that really comes out.
It does.
It's unmistakable.
It does. It makes more significance out of expressions relative to time. That's right. That's right.
That comes out at you.
Yes, it does. It amplifies it.
You know, Daniel was in the first kingdom, the golden dead. He was there with Nebuchadnezzar. He's seen revealed what that vision was. Whatever the legs and feet of iron and clay are, that's what that fourth kingdom is over here in this church.
That's right. Diverse.
Right. If you go back, I mean, each dream gave a little bit more and stuff, but if you go back to that, that's the kingdom when the stone came rolling down and destroyed it, the one that would be everlasting. We know that that is the kingdom of God, the church. So this fourth kingdom has to be Rome. And
has to be.
Yeah. There's no other way to tell it.
Yeah.
You know, the premillennialists, each king is a kingdom that goes, you know, you're ready.
It has to be. When you couple and overlay Daniel 2 with Daniel 7, and then when you couple into that Hebrews 12:28, the conclusion becomes inescapable that this has to be, the fourth kingdom has to be the Roman kings, and the king or the kingdom that will break in pieces and consume all others has to be, it just has to be, the kingdom of God, the kingdom of Christ that was established in Acts chapter 2. And the reason we know that that has to be so, and if you haven't remembered this, write it down. It's crucial. And that is in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28. It tells us that those Hebrews were receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken. Cannot be shaken. This is what they were becoming a part of. A kingdom that cannot be shaken. But the kingdom of Daniel 2, verse 44, was one that cannot be moved. And it would break in pieces and consume all others and stand forever. How can you have a kingdom that cannot be moved, that's going to come up against one also that cannot be moved or cannot be shaken, but yet Kingdom A is going to break in pieces and consume all others, including Kingdom B? How can that be so if they are not one and the same? In other words, how can you have one that's going to break in pieces and consume all others confronting one that's indestructible? Can't be so, can it? Unless they are one and the same kingdom. So the kingdom that Daniel is prophesying that would come to pass during the days of the fourth world kingdom, that is the days of the Roman kings, is indeed the kingdom of Christ. And Terry, the time element is crucial in this as we look into the New Testament and find expressions, the time is fulfilled. Repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And you find numerous expressions like that. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven is nigh. All of those expressions are relevant as we consider this timetable. Terry?
And along with that, I think maybe 7 times in the book of John, Jesus says, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Jesus makes reference to a certain hour.
That's right.
The hour had not yet come, and reference to that hour has now come.
That is correct. That is correct. Numerous times throughout the Gospel of John that statement is made. And that likewise fits on the timetable, showing the nearness of this time. Yes.
Was that through Mark 9:1?
Oh yeah, we don't want to miss Mark 9:1.
Mark 9:1, Jesus was saying to them, "Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come in power."
All right, so that establishes that some in that very generation would not die until they saw the kingdom established. They would see it established. Now, that couples some things together. Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 2 with the prophecy of Jesus in Mark 1, 14 and 15. And with, I'm sorry, Mark 9, verse 1. Mark 1, 14, 15, then Mark 9, verse 1. When we get all those in place, we find fulfillment then in Acts chapter 2 where the Apostle Peter declares, "This is that. This is it. This is what the prophets were pointing to. This is the very thing." You'll see that in Acts 2, verse 16. "This is that which Joel prophesied that should come to pass in the last days." So if Daniel is speaking of things which shall come to pass in the last days, and we know he was because Daniel identifies that to Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel 2 about verse 16. And Joel is talking about things that would come to pass in the last days. Isaiah talked about things that would come to pass in the last days. And Peter says in Acts 2, this is it. This is what the prophets were talking about. So we find it all coming together in Acts chapter 2 with the establishment of the kingdom, fitting on the timeline just precisely as it had been prophesied. Okay? Did you ring that bell just once or twice?
Just once.
Okay. I was just wondering.
4 whole minutes left.
4 whole minutes. Well, let's see if we can finish the 7th chapter. We see these kingdoms identified in terms of these beasts. But yet we want to notice that the Ancient of Days appeared at verse 9. It says, "And I beheld till thrones were placed, and one that was Ancient of Days did sit. And his raiment was white as snow, and his hair, the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, and the wheels thereof burning fire." Now, who are we reading about when we talk about the Ancient of Days? That's God. Dropping down further into this text, it says at verse 11, "I beheld at this time because of the voice of the great words which the horn spake. And I beheld even till the beast was slain and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire." Who are we talking about, this great beast that had great words? This great beast which the horn spake. Who are we talking about? The Persians. All right? And so we see great swelling words coming from them. And during these days, what would God do? In verse 13, it says, And I saw in the night visions, and behold, there came with the clouds of heaven one like unto a son of man. And he came even unto the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Now think with me, as we go back to Daniel 2 again, in verse 44 and 45, what was the nature of the kingdom that would be given in the days of these kings, that is, in the days of the Roman kings? Would be an everlasting kingdom. The dominion would be an everlasting dominion. What is this that one likened to the Son of Man would receive when he would ascend unto the Ancient of Days? What kind of kingdom would he receive? An everlasting kingdom. Do you see that? Is it one and the same? Now, if we understand the difference between ascend and descend, we've made this point a number of times, but it's a valid point, I believe. If we can understand the difference between ascend and descend, then we've got this premillennial thing wrapped up. When did Jesus receive his kingdom? Was it when he ascended or when he descends? It says when he ascended to the Ancient of Days. What will happen to the kingdom when he descends? He will give it back to the Father. It will not be established according to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I believe it's verses 24 and 25. The kingdom would be given to the Father. It would not be given unto the Son, but the Son would give it to the Father. Now the time frame in that is altogether different. We've got him ascending after his death, burial, his resurrection. He ascended unto the right hand of the Father, exalted and given power and honor and glory according to the teaching of Ephesians chapter 1, verses 22 and 23. But when he descends, according to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 24 and 25, the kingdom will then be given to the Father. Does that make any difference to us? Well, it makes all the difference in the world, because it helps us to see when the kingdom was established on this timeline that Terry's talking about. The kingdom is not established way down here at the end of the timeline. The kingdom was established back here in Acts chapter 2, about 33 A.D. on the timeline. Now that makes all the difference in the world. And that difference means you can be a part of the kingdom that was given unto Jesus when he ascended to the right hand of the Father.
It also means it's the oldest kingdom on earth today.
All right.
It's outlived all the other kingdoms. Kingdoms come and go.
All right. It'll break in pieces and consume all others, and it will stand. It will stand forever. All right. Richard's telling me we're out of time, so we'll have to pick up on chapter 7. Be sure and read these last chapters two or three times so that we'll be familiar with them in our next study to review over them again. Okay? Yeah, I'll just close it.